Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel for the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Arnab Datta Roy, an assistant professor of world literature and postcolonial theory at Florida Gulf Coast University. Today, I have the great privilege and honor to welcome Professor Anki Mukherjee and Professor Atto Krissen, who will be speaking about their fascinating new edited volume from Cambridge University Press, Decolonizing the English Literary Curriculum. Before I begin, I would like to briefly introduce our guests to the audience. Professor Anki Mukherjee is Professor of English and World Literatures at the University of Oxford and a Fellow of Wadham College. Her recent books are Unseen City, The Psychic Lives of the Urban Poor, Cambridge University Press, 2021, which won the Robert S. Liebert Award for Outstanding Scholarship in Applied Psychoanalysis, and What is a Classic, Postcolonial Rewriting and Invention of the Canon, Stanford University Press, 2014. Which won the British Academy Prize in English Literature in 2015. Professor Mukherjee's other publications include Aesthetic Hysteria, The Great Neurosis in Victorian Melodrama and Contemporary Fiction, and the edited collections, A Concise Companion to Psychoanalysis, Literature and Culture, and After Lacan. Professor Mukherjee has published extensively in peer-reviewed literary journals and sits on the editorial boards of several international ones. She has been a research fellow of the British Academy, visiting fellow at the Australian National University, and the John Hinckley visiting professor at Johns Hopkins. She was invited faculty at the Institute of World Literature at Harvard University in 2023. Professor Mukherjee is currently writing a very short introduction of postcolonial literatures forthcoming with Oxford University Press. Decolonizing the English Literary Curriculum, which is the volume that we will be discussing today, and which she has co-edited with Professor Atto Krissen, was published last year. Our other guest, Professor Atto Krissen, is the Jean G. and Morris M. Professor of Interdisciplinary Studies and Chair of the Department of English at Stanford University. His books include the two-volume edited Cambridge History of Postcolonial Literature, Tragedy and Postcolonial Literature, which won the Warren Brooks Prize for Literary Criticism, and Oxford Street, Accra, City Life and the Itineraries of Transnationalism, which won the Urban History Association Prize. He is the editor of the Cambridge Journal of Postcolonial Literary Inquiry, and the host of Cambridge Contours, the Cambridge Literary Studies Hour. He has also curated critic reading, writing, a YouTube channel dedicated to themes in the interdisciplinary literary humanities. He is elected fellow at the Ghana Academy of Arts and Sciences, the Royal Society of Canada, the British Academy, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Anki Atto, welcome to this podcast, and thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedules to speak with me today.
Thank you, Arnav.
Thank you, Arnav.
So, let me start with the first question. It's basically, I'll ask you to introduce yourselves. Can you tell us a little bit about your academic journeys? What inspires you to do what you do as a scholar, as a writer, as a teacher? Can we start with you, Anki?
Thank you. I'll start with my PhD, which was on the history of hysteria in Victorian literature and culture. And when I finished my PhD, my first job was at Oxford, where it turned out that I was going to be succeeding a very formidable postcolonial studies scholar, namely Robert Young. So I felt a bit ashamed that, you know, somebody who's not only Indian origin, but born and raised in a small town, and also studied in a small town, that I was going to be kind of, in a way, bringing to a halt this gallop of postcolonial studies across Oxford. So I started doing more postcolonial literature teaching. Of course, as I said, you know, I grew up in India, I have 5 Indian languages, and I've always studied postcolonial literature. And theory, but my focus was more Victorian studies. And what brings these two fields together, I would say, is sort of kind of a very deep-seated interest in psychoanalysis. And my teaching is English literature 1760 to the present. So it's a very, very vast range, you know, comprising of Romantic, Victorian, and modern literature. But my research tends to be sort of in specialized sort of areas of this vast spread. And I would say that, you know, my methodology is very strongly influenced by, of course, postcolonial studies, world literature studies, but also the history of medicine and in particular, the history of psychoanalysis.
Thank you so much. Atto?
Well, for me, I decided to do a literature degree against my father's. My father wanted me to be a lawyer. But I decided to do a literature degree because when I was going to university, I was very, very lazy. And I wanted to do a subject that would allow me to spend as much time in bed as possible. And literature seemed to be just the right candidate. Of course, I was an avid reader. And so I spent much of my undergraduate years, apart, of course, from going to lectures and classes, reading in bed. It was the most pleasurable. I can't even begin to tell you how much I enjoyed being in bed and reading. Of course, what I didn't realize was that it got more and more complicated, you know, as you proceeded. So that now I barely sleep. People who know me will attest to that. And then I went to graduate school at Cambridge University, and my PhD was on literary history, Nigerian literary history. I come from Ghana, but I did Nigerian literary history. And that was an eye-opener because literary history allows you to see things in the long durée in terms of both rhetoric, you know, rhetorical devices and the relay of things among texts and discourses. And that book also, the PhD was published, and then I got a job at Cambridge. And like Anki, I didn't know what postcolonialism was, even though I was doing postcolonial studies at the time. So it was in conversation with a friend of mine from South Africa. She's Indian from South Africa, who said I should learn more about this field. In fact, she was responsible for my second book, on postcolonial studies. And so I delved into it. And of course, I then had the shock of recognition because actually much of what I was doing in African literary studies was indeed, it fell into postcolonial studies. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I continued in that trajectory. I would say that the thing that motivates me most and that I enjoy most about doing what I do is actually teaching. So communication. I always say that the classroom is the place of revitalization, is a place where once I interact with young minds or other minds, I feel revitalized in my own mind. So that's the main driver is, and so the volume, Decolonizing the English Literary Curriculum, is about teaching. Is about how we teach what we teach in a way that would be more accommodating to perspectives that have hitherto not been given enough space.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So I think that kind of seamlessly brings us to our next question. Can you tell us about your book, Decolonizing the English Literary Curriculum? And I mean, this is just like, if you were to identify, say, like two or three major interventions of this book, what would they be? So, Ato, can we start with you?
Okay. Well, for a very long time, at least since the 1960s and speeding up in the 1980s, there have always been calls to reform the curriculum to make it more representative. And this was partly under pressure from the demographic changes in both in Europe and in North America. So demographic changes also meant that more Black and brown folk were now at universities, and they wanted to see themselves reflected in what they were being taught as literature. In a way, that argument about additions, so reform the curriculum originally was just add more of us, add more of brown and Black folk, and so on and so forth. That argument is now, as it were, it's been won in the sense that there's no respectable English department anywhere that will resist that argument. The question then arises, two questions arise. One is what to add, because there's lots to add, and how to teach what is added. So that's one of the things that we think about in our volume. How do you teach minority writing? And there are certain principles. I should add very quickly that decolonizing is context specific. So decolonizing in New Zealand and Australia is not the same as decolonizing in Wisconsin, Madison. You have to do something different because the context is different. But there are general rules, which include the sort of taking these texts not just as sources of anthropological information. Because unfortunately, that's how minority texts are read in the dominant culture. They read as a guide notes. You read Chinua Achebe to know about Igbo culture, or you read an Indian author to know about Indian culture, and so on. But and this is a very important point, that these are first and foremost literary texts. We have to embed them in certain contexts, but ultimately you have to give them the kind of serious attention that they require. The final thing, there are many other things that our volume is trying to do. Our volume is also trying to show the wide diversity of what me, Anke and I call perspectives from equity-seeking groups. So it's not only postcolonials who have been trying to shake the curriculum. The curriculum has been shaken by women's groups. Women have tried to shake, gender non-conforming groups, Jews, Muslims, native, indigenous populations, and so on. So the other point that we try to insist upon is that the decolonizing curriculum has to be intersectional. It's not just from a postcolonial perspective. It has to be from various perspectives all at once. Because the point is to seek equity for all, not for some.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much, Anki.
Yes, and it's something that, I have been thinking about because it's not just doing a book called Decolonizing the English Literary Curriculum. The presence in the academy of someone like Atul or someone like me is in itself doing or doing some kind of disorganizing or dismantling work, whether though we are, in my case, this is something that made me write What is a Classic, because one of the things that I found almost absurd is that I'm someone who grew up in Bordhoman, a small town in West Bengal. I read almost all the classics that I now teach, such as Jane Eyre, in Bengali before I read them in English, and now I was the sort of instrument through which the English canon was being transmitted to a group of undergraduates, most of whom were from, they were sort of home students, at a stretch, home and EU, as we used to call them before Brexit. So it is this kind of absurdity of your own place, where which you're constantly thinking about, that what exactly, how exactly am I repeating with a difference? What kind of unwitting subversion is this? So this is there, but decolonization is a much stronger word than this kind of work that I have just described, which could be sort of, in a way, the deployment of a postcolonial worldview, a postcolonial lived experience to the transmission of the canon. Decolonization is a sort of a more radical process. It is about a complete disorganization and upheaval. And it is, when you say decolonization, it also kind of means that post-coloniality hasn't quite come to be. So I do think that we wrote this, we started thinking about this in the immediate context of George Floyd's murder, in the immediate context of the return of, let's say something like Rose Must Fall to Oxford, and thinking that how on earth can the classroom not try to connect itself to, as Arthur said, these sort of intersectional calls for social change, for social equality, for equity. And decolonization is about, it is not just a reversal. It is not a reversal of the violence of colonialism, but it is kind of ushering in a very different method. It's not, this homeopathic injection of brown and black and East Asian writing, but kind of really trying to understand the value criteria that direct and that kind of inform what we read, how we teach, who we teach this to, the different kinds of access and outreach possibilities of teaching English. So I would say that, and to answer your question, what do you think we are doing that will leave a lasting impact? I mean, we are thinking like a collective, a non-identical collective. And one of the key strengths of this book is not just a sort of, geopolitical scope, but we are also sort of, as Arthur said, that, he likes to teach, as do I. I mean, teaching is sort of, it is one, it is the space where I'm kind of most unproblematically myself. And we are also sort of assuming that role. So to give you an example, in my chapter, I'm trying to think about how I, who is Indian, but who's often sort of, in a way, in statistical terms, counted as black, how do I teach black British literature without sort of, in a way, adding certain pieties that this is this I need to sort of teach this more reverentially, because it is representing an extraordinarily historically oppressed group. But how exactly do we sort of teach someone like Zadie Smith, who's actually pushing back against that kind of an kind of simplistic reading? And therefore, while writing the chapter, I am confronting my own prejudices that, to some extent, my teaching is some kind of a historical corrective to racism, when that is not why we should only teach literature. We should teach literature because we are showing students that look at the sort of intrinsic merit, the play of signifier, the kind of the verve and ambition of this particular act of literature. So yes, of course, you know, the social and political context can never be divorced from any kind of teaching or reading, but we need to also kind of, you know, always think of the aesthetic in relation to any kind of political framing of the work.
Thank you so much. These are so important concerns that you have highlighted, which I hope we'll be able to like dissect like more specifically in the different questions that would follow. So, but I do have a follow-up question though about like the broad, like your approach to this project, right? So I mean, you have like what, 26 chapters. So how did you like arrange it, structure it? What went behind the planning of this huge volume that has so many different like attentions and so many different focuses? Can you speak to like your work behind organizing the whole project?
Well, just quickly, 27 chapters,
yeah.
But Anki can take.
Anki.
27 chapters.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Got your happy price, Priceline.
Yes, I mean, I'm looking at the book. You know, we have four sections: identities, methodologies, interdisciplinarity, and literary studies and canon revisions. And these are not sort of watertight chapters. You know, there are kind of a lot of overlap between, let's say, a chapter on not teaching African literature ethnographically with not teaching Black British literature ethnographically. What we had in mind was scope. We tried our best. This is something like this can never really represent every equity seeking group, as Atu says, but we were thinking about scholars who think intersectionally, who have a sort of a commitment to kind of, in a way, a curriculum revision and expansion in the sense that their own work has revitalized certain core areas of kind of this periodized literary study, while also bringing that extra that it's kind of, they have, you know, for instance, Nigel Leask, you know, who has really sort of revolutionized the way in which we consider the connection between romantic studies and empire. So we did have we were drawing on the work that, you know, some of these contributors did, and thought how wonderful if he would be able to do that sort of a bird's eye view chapter on how to decolonize the 18th century literature and critical theory curriculum. So, you know, I mean, we were both thinking big, but we were also thinking in a very sort of microscopic way that, you know, people who would be able to address their own place, space, and time. Paul Giles is writing about Australia in connection with his oversight of the university as a whole, but also sort of in a way, kind of go big, you know, kind of provide a blueprint for scaling up. So what Nigel Leask, to again go back to that example, is he starts with a contemplation of his own Regis chair, which is something that has a very strong sort of colonial history. So nothing is innocent of meaning in the university when you think about how the curriculum itself, and I mean, I'm sure you know Gauri Vishwanathan's Masks of Conquest, looking at how the curriculum, actually the framing of the curriculum, was very much part of the kind of population management that
exactly
happened in India.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Anto, did you want
to... Well, just quickly, I mean, I don't have much to add to Anki's response, but in terms of, it's impossible, there are things that we didn't include. For example, decolonizing science fiction. You know, science fiction, because of course, science fiction requires... we have to reflect on it, or decolonizing graphic novels, for example. So there are areas that we couldn't, but what we wanted to do was for people, to invite people who had reflected on these questions. Nigel Leask is a great example because his chapter starts by positioning himself as Regis Chair in the field. And then he gives us a reconstruction of the field that shows his blindness. That's a very, very good, you know, it provides a very good window into. But the other really good chapter is in the same canon revision section, is Geraldine Heng, Decolonizing the Medieval Literary Curriculum. Her chapter is highly intersectional, you know, because she talks not just about the ways in which, so most medievalists will argue that race as a category is irrelevant to medieval studies. Race as a category appears much later. Now, her argument is that race had surrogates, you know, so a conversion, you know, so the encounter with different religions, often the religions were codes for a form of racialization and so on. It's a wonderful chapter. It's very intersectional. But also the chapter by Ronald Charles, Decolonizing the Bible. Because, of course, in English literary studies, the Bible is everywhere. You know, we don't think about it. It becomes a kind of inert wallpaper. But he looks at how the rereading the Revelations, you know, both contextually in the period in when it was written and what it was being used for, but also in a different context in terms of application. In he's from Haiti. In Haiti, what the Haitian evangelicals are doing with this apocalyptic text, and how they are. I mean, from his account, you can see that there's a lot of misinterpretation and misapplication, but it's strategic. So these are some of the things, and there are many other examples we can highlight, you know, Stefan Hegelson on Marxism and postcolonialism, which also allows us a different genealogy. It's a braided genealogy of postcolonial studies, because postcolonial studies has always been in dialogue and sometimes contradiction with Marxism. Beautiful chapter. So that was our interest. Our interest is the general purview, decolonizing, but be as specific as possible. So each chapter will perform a service which is specific. You know, Anki's chapter on teaching Zadie Smith, for example, it's a particular, so it's not just Zadie Smith he's writing about, but some Black women's writing in the United Kingdom. So all of a sudden, you are seeing it differently. So that's what informed our choices of, we could have doubled the size of the book if we had time. Yeah, easily could have doubled the size of the book.
If I can just add one more thing, Arnab, is that in our brief and also in our conversations with the authors, we tried to have a balance between the philosophical and also the pragmatic, you know, as Arto says, you know, bringing it back to the classroom, that on the one hand, we are thinking about transcription, we are thinking of archive, we are thinking about the multilingual origins of English, we are thinking about, you know, the relationship between metropolitan and vernacular. So we are thinking also very practically about the issue, not just kind of, you know, in a way metaphysically and philosophically. And I think this really was something that, you know, that helped us, that these are not just sort of theoretical questions, but we are routinely looking at the classroom as it connects to.
We're grounding these seeming abstractions into the context of the classroom.
I'm just in awe. Like, I'm just in awe of the kind of breadth and purview, as you say, of like the scope of this volume, like both like geographically, conceptually, temporally, you know, like time and space, everything, like the kind, all these different offerings that you have brought together, and you have been able to successfully make them speak to each other. That's like a feat in itself, I feel. So thank you so much for talking about this. So, I mean, I think we can go into the specifics a little bit now. Since this book is about decolonizing the English literary curriculum, can we first talk a little about the term decolonization? How are you defining it in this book, especially in drawing attention to how it is distinct yet interconnected with two of the other terms that also keep coming up in the book, post-colonial and anti-colonial. So, Anki, can we start with you?
Yes, and we sort of addressed this in the introduction, Arnab, that why are we talking about decolonizing in the age of the post-colonial? I mean, decolonization is a term that was, you know, used in kind of Asia and Africa in the 1940s as these countries started to free themselves from Western rule. And that is, we do address that it is a problem of time and it is a problem of our time. It is about sort of an interrupted futurity. You know, if we think of the post-colonial as in something that comes after the time of the colonial as this ideality or futurity, you can see I'm echoing sort of Jose Munoz's terms here, then that hasn't quite happened. You know, you can see, and I do think that we keep going back to the murder of George Floyd because the connection between a sort of systematic colonialism and slavery and the way in which contemporary Western societies worked was made all too obvious that, you know, you did have this kind of like a law and order structure, which was ingrained with, you know, these ideas of racial difference. So we were forced to kind of in a way go back to why hasn't post-coloniality been achieved and what might it mean to ask for something kind of a much more radical, much more extensive, and also much more kind of in a way, as we have said about the way in which we have done the different chapters, much more sort of multifaceted. And the relationship with the post-colonial is that this is about a sort of disrupted post-coloniality. It is about sort of, and I talk about, you know, the time of the decolonization, and this is a really wonderful article by Simon Gekandi on Chinua Achebe's Arrow of God, where he thinks of it as an interregnum. You know, it is kind of this kind of peculiar kind of waiting room of history between a past that is continuing to shape the modern and a future that you can't quite, you know, can't quite grasp. Mm-hmm. And it is that sort of time of interregnum. And with anti-colonial, you know, and as you know, we have cited, you know, Priyambada Gopal's sort of, you know, a very powerful article that we need to clearly at this point, decolonization has to go back again to the anti-colonial thought, you know, to anti-colonial efforts and draw inspiration from kind of anti-colonial thought. But this is, I mean, I do think decolonization is something much more, it is, Fano says that we do it with our muscles and our brains. It is an extremely, extremely disruptive process. It is not a smooth transition from the end of colonial rule to what might come after it, you know, that this is something we have known in even in post-colonial literature, that's precisely what Salman Rushdie's Midnight Children is about, that this newly minted nation, the promise of the newly minted nation didn't come to be. That promise was sort of, you know, frittered away.
Thank you.
Well, Anki has very fully, the thing also we must not ignore is that global capitalism is still doing lots of things to keep the formerly colonized in forms of bondage, economic bondage, you know, the loans that we have to take from the IMF and so on, the guardianship. So for example, the unequal terms of trade, in that many post colonies still provide their primary produce. And the processed products are then they're processed elsewhere in Europe or America, and then sent back. The nature of the labor market, for example, that there's a form of the United States, for example, accept it's a land of immigration, so a lot of migrants come here. But when they arrive, no matter what kind of background they have, educated, they are de-skilled. There's a lot of this. So international migration goes with de-skilling. Lots of people have degrees from wherever they come from, but they are de-skilled. They are de-skilled, so they increase the labor, the pool of surplus labor. And so, in other words, they are still colonial, both events and the processes that are ongoing. And never mind the fact, as David Scott in Conscripts of Modernity argued very persuasively, that the post-colonized countries have reverted to forms of politics that are not necessarily liberated. India is a great example. India is a great example. South Africa has gone through periods where you wondered what's the difference between the post-colony and the colonial, and so on. And lots of countries formerly colonized, whose governments are, Sri Lanka is another example, whose the political logic is completely still colonial. So the decolonizing is also to scrutinize the forms of unfreedom now. There's a lot of unfreedom, the forms of unfreedom now, and how we reflect on them and how we find pathways, not just to understand, but to break free of them.
That is fascinating. Thank you so much. I did have a follow-up question on this as well. So, you'd like Anki, you mentioned about Gopal, and the idea and of the anti-colonial university. So, I mean, I'm thinking like, how does that the idea of the anti-colonial university fit into your vision of decolonization? Like knowing that like. We are, after all, a part of an institution that has deep colonial roots. So, how do we navigate these through the idea of anti-colonial university? Can you speak to that a little?
I can sort of like I mean this kind of actually is goes very well with what Arthur was saying about global capitalism, you know, that kind of knowledge is very much, as we know, the product of the neoliberal university, and one of the ways in which we as humanity scholars are constantly trying to sort of try to extend the benefit of a humanities education is showing how it can also, though it is a product of the neoliberal university, it can also be a set of conjectures. It can be about different and contesting, you know, viewpoints. And this kind of, you know, this Kantian idea of sort of working at unfinished knowledge, you know, I mean, so these are the ways in which humanities is doing this work already. And to go back to, you know, our volume, and when we had asked, you know, somebody to write about the Bible and decolonizing the English literary curriculum, or history of medicine and decolonizing the English literary curriculum, we did have agonized emails from these authors saying, how exactly did you think this had relevance to English literature? And we, like the good analysts that we are, we returned their truths to them, saying, look at the way in which you are reading history of medicine through the toolkit of literary criticism, through the toolkit of literature in English. You know, Sloane Mahone's chapter dwells on Bessie Head. So we were saying to them, look at how you are decolonizing history of medicine through the sort of insights that you've gleaned from your study of literature. So, I mean, I do think that this kind of and as Arthur says, that it could have been a much bigger book. And I always think of that sort of very famous anecdote of Latour about, you know, he's going to a sort of French run, I think it's an engineering school somewhere in the Ivory Coast, and he talks it up. Calls it a sort of racist situation. He says it's a racist situation that is hidden behind cognitive, pseudo-historical and cultural explanations. So we do think that this infection will take root, and people will start thinking about decolonizing, not just sort of in a way subjects such as English literature, which obviously has a very strong connection to the civilizing mission, to the role of colonial education in, you know, erstwhile colonies, but also, you know, subjects such as science. And so, yes, I mean, to kind of go back to that, I do think that what we have done with the English literary curriculum is a very interesting template which can be used with other humanities subjects, but also other science subjects. And in that way, we can, I mean, no one can deny, you know, that we inhabit kind of a neoliberal university, but we can still sort of, in a way, make sure that, I mean, Edward Said says this in his revision of Orientalism, that if I did not believe that knowledge could not be non-coercive, I wouldn't write this book. So, you know, this is somebody who has written about the sort of inextricable implication of knowledge and power. But he says, I would have not been able to write this if I didn't have the hope that knowledge can be non-coercive. Similarly, I mean, I do think that though we inhabit these global capitalist neoliberal structures, we still have this hope that knowledge can be contestatory, knowledge can be non-coercive, you know, and it can be emancipatory.
Thank you. Thank you. Ato, do you have...
Just quickly, the one wonderful thing that Anki said about the toolkit of English literature for decolonizing other fields, such as medical humanities, biblical studies, and so on and so forth. Because this is something, we mentioned this in passing in our introduction. That is, so people use literary texts in context other than literature classrooms. This is anthropologists use it, history. Historians use literary texts all the time to illustrate various things. Obviously the medical humanities and even in the cognitive sciences, you know, neurobiology and cognitive sciences and so on. So for example, detective fiction. What does detective fiction do? It's not just in the English literature classroom. So the tools of, going back to Anke's point, that when we invited Malone, and she was wondering, what am I going to do? She said, use the tools of English literature to look again at the medical humanities, at the history of medicine, and see what comes up. So in fact, there's more than one prong, you know, it's a multi-pronged approach. It is decolonizing the literature classroom, but also deploying the toolkits from literature to look again in a different way at different disciplines and areas.
Thank you. I mean, I think like our next question kind of is connected with this. So what do you think are the main challenges that challenges to decolonizing the curriculum, and how does one constructively try to address those challenges? Ato, do you want to start?
First thing, of course, is personnel.
Yes.
You know, that's actually the starting point. We need more people of color, black and brown people. We need more women. We need more disabled people. We need more, and so on and so forth. And there was always going to be bump against the limit. There just is not enough resources. So what happens is that those of us who have money to get into the system, we are overburdened. No week passes where I don't think of something new I might teach to, you know, to change perspective, but I can't do it all by myself. So the first challenge is, people, you know, the personnel, how to actually increase the number of underrepresented minorities, women, indigenous peoples, and so on and so on. That's always going to be a challenge, because they'll tell you, we just don't have the budget. We have many priorities. So that's the first thing. The second thing is for departments to acknowledge that actually we do have a problem. So the small shift from English literature to literature in English, you'll be amazed at how radical that shift is. Because English literature places the literature originally written in English at the apogee, and also Britlit. Britlit, you know, so that's the height of it. And then the rest comes somewhere. Whereas if you think of literatures in English, that's a completely different ballgame. The other really radical, thing that this will, we're talking about difficulties. There's a chapter in the book by Aksha, Saxena, on vernaculars, English and vernaculars. And she makes a really fascinating point about English being a vernacular in India. So English being one of vernacular, and that, what are the implications of taking English as a vernacular in England? But actually, there's a more radical imputation from what she says, because English is a vernacular in England itself. So if you've been to England before, you will know that someone coming from Liverpool speaks a kind of English that you can barely understand from compared to someone who has been to Oxford or Cambridge and so on and so forth. So that actually there are vernacular forms of the English language, and there's a politics to speaking or writing in a certain way in English in the United Kingdom itself. So in other words, that language is a political instrument. So it's not just a kind of transparent medium. There's no transparency to it. But as soon as you start investigating the language itself as a vernacular among vernaculars to itself, you come to see how politicized it is. Of course, this point was made, but not in this way, by Griffiths et al., the Empire Writes Back. They wrote about Englishes, but they didn't conceive of English as a vernacular. They were thinking of Englishes elsewhere, you know, in the Caribbean, in Africa, in India, which is fine, but that was the first installment of the argument. English, variants of English are vernaculars inside of England itself. And this is actually, but to get people to acknowledge, you know, that there are these difficulties. We have to keep expanding the imagination of our colleagues, because sometimes the resistance is due to a failure of imagination. What will Chinua Achebe teach me about Sophocles? Someone might ask, you know, why should I read, you know, Salman Rushdie? What will he teach me about the history of the English novel? Something like that. It's actually a failure of imagination, but we know what to teach you. You know, Anki and I, and those of us who work in this area, of course, if you want to understand Sophocles, Oedipus Rex, read Achebe. And you see, you know, the comparisons and so on. So the other thing is, there's a kind of failure of imagination, which we always have to contend with, which I would like to say now less than, say, 20 years ago, but it's still there. In the sense that you have to persuade them that what we are doing is serious stuff, is good for the curriculum in general. Sorry, from time to time, I mean, my light is on, kind of ridiculous, and it keeps going off. I've asked them to come and increase it. So I have to always get up and do a jig.
Auntie,
for me, you know, the key challenge from my sort of location is that sort of very pernicious division between the core curriculum and electives, that what has to be transmitted, because so much of a kind of traditional English literature course is actually the transmission of literary history from Old English to, I mean, we don't say this anymore, but when I first joined, you know, people would say Beowulf to Virginia Woolf, you know, which is kind of scary. That's kind of where, when I joined in 2002 as a postdoc, you know, this is where, this is how the English literary history was seen. Virginia Woolf was the modern. And so for me, that needs to be dismantled, that, you know, there are certain compulsory papers. And yes, you do have, you know, scholars, these sort of agonized kind of questions that how on earth can I teach a person of color when there are no women, let alone person of color, writing in this century in English. And there are so many ways in which you can revitalize. And this is something, you know, the chapter on Shakespeare is looking at what is being done to Shakespeare in the US-Mexico borderland. You know, how, and I do think that while so much of our thinking, literary critical thinking, is informed by T.S. Eliot's idea of, you know, a tradition and individual talent. You know, his argument is that there's this hypertrophic tradition, but an individual talent has to situate itself in that tradition. Mm-hmm. But the second, fair enough. So you have to, this is not IT. We don't, you know, treat the past as dead wood. But the second part of his assertion, that new talent also shakes up tradition, we don't kind of think along those lines, that every belated writing, every belated, you know, something with talent has the potential to actually really deconstruct the tradition that he is himself saying is very important for that newness. So it's a sort of very, very symbiotic relationship that we don't quite remember, that it's very important for any field to stay alive, to be read by all the readers that can read it. Now, you know, I mean, there are more, there will be in the near future more sort of non-English English readers than there are today, you know, with the sort of spread of English in China, for instance, spread of English in India. So for these periods to remain vital, they will have to connect to these translations and adaptations and afterlives, you know. But I do think that we need to kind of in a way go back and to, as Arto said, that what will this teach me about Sophocles? And we need to kind of say that this is not, this presence is always already there. You know, Byron is thinking about Asia, Dickens is sort of, you know, thinking about the sepoy mutiny in India. And these are, on the history is very much there. I mean, this is Toni Morrison's very powerful argument in Playing in the Dark, that American literature, which has for the large part completely ignored the Black presence, is actually only understandable vis-a-vis the Black presence, that all these characteristics that we associate with American literature would be meaningless if we did not think about its suppression and repression of that Black presence. So there are many ways in which we can dismantle that center-periphery divide, this idea that certain things are important and compulsory and other things are a hobby, because it is a sort of connected world, you know, to go back to that slogan, you know, I'm here because you are there. And that's the way the world is, and that's even more so today. And also kind of in a way, so not just sort of saying that there is this presence, but also looking at the way in which tradition can continue to stay relevant only when it allows, you know, these sort of insurgents and these sort of Turks from elsewhere to come and sort of intervene. Often, you know, I mean, Lacan says, you know, I love you, therefore I mutilate you. That mutilation is an act of love. It's a desire to engage with the past, which has actually been complicit in my colonization, in my sort of subjugation. But I still want to engage with it.
So this book is definitely going to be an important resource, not just for researchers, academics, scholars, students of literary studies, humanities, social sciences, but it's also going to be an important resource for educators at different institutions looking to decolonize their curriculums and educational programs. I mean, I myself am a part of a team that is tasked with rethinking and reorganizing the world literature curriculum in my university at FGCU. So keeping this idea in mind, what recommendation or advice do you have for departments and faculties aiming to decolonize their curriculums? What steps can they take? What must one focus on? What pitfalls should they be mindful of? What should they prioritize? Atto, do you want to?
Hire more people. Hire more people who can teach this stuff. That's a baseline. They will say we don't have money, but that should always be repeated. Hire more people. But in terms of even the you know, the personnel that are available, think of the relationship between the core curriculum, and every the English department has a core and has electives. Think of the relationship between the core and the electives in a more dynamic way, in the sense that the electives are not to be conceptualized as enclaves. A course on Indian literature is not simply a course on Indian literature. It's a portal to understand the curriculum in general. And the syllabus, the you know, African literature or minority writing or women's writing has to be crafted in such a way that it's in constant dialogue with the larger, you know, the curriculum. In other words, the curriculum has to be dynamic in all its parts. So it's not core than electives. You know, electives and core are always in conversation. You know, the point that, you know, Anki and I were making about, Achebe will tell you something about Sophocles. There's a way of incorporating that insight into a syllabus, in the sense that you are not reading Achebe, and this is what I tell my students all the time, like you are reading the New York Times. Achebe is not a journalist. And Things Fall Apart is not a journalism. It's a piece of literature. But how do you read it, bearing in mind all the other literary texts that surround it and impinging upon it, not just from Africa? You know, so that's the first thing. The other thing is that us who teach minority literatures have done due diligence in understanding the canon. For example, I teach courses on Shakespeare. I teach courses on tragedy. I can dilate on any number of texts. Same with Anki. Our colleagues, because under the guise of specialisms or specialization, they don't continue their education into other areas outside of what they're looking at. And I think that's bad, because in the end, the core areas become, you know, fossilized. They are separated from trends elsewhere. So this also requires that the way we train our graduate students and our faculty, they should always be thinking of, what do I need to learn more? Do I need to do something about, Latinx women's writing? I'm a medievalist. But do I need to learn more about Latinx women's writing and see whether it might animate something in medievals? I mean, I don't know, but it's a good thing to, so that the individuals and the curriculum have to be dynamically interacting with each other all the time. And the final thing is the way we read. You know, the attention that the Miltonist requires to deliver an idea on Milton, it suddenly switches off when you have to read Zadie Smith, just to take an example. On the Zadie Smith, she's talking about Black women, multiculturalism. We know what it is, just forget about it. No, Zadie Smith is a serious writer, and her works are actually quite challenging, you know? So they have to be attended to not as testimonials. I think I may have mentioned this already. They are not testaments to Black life or mere testaments to Black life. Obviously, they are, but Zadie Smith is doing much more than that. And Anki's chapter actually makes a point of this, that Zadie Smith feels a kinship with people from in the canon. E.M. Foster, she said this more than once. E.M. Foster, she feels a kinship with E.M. Foster. So how would we understand Zadie Smith in dialogue with E.M. Foster? Anyway, so the curriculum, this business of core and then electives, it's a practical, it has practical usage, but it's fossil. Some people can take a degree, English degree, and never once have even heard of Salman Rushdie, because it's not obligatory. You know, it's not entirely possible to complete the degree,
yes,
never have even heard of Rushdie. Why? And never mind reading it. That should be impossible. It should be impossible for you to complete an English degree anywhere in the world today and not have, had a deep engagement with the writings from outside Euro-America.
Thank you.
I just wanted to, Arthur has really covered this so beautifully. I wanted to add something he wrote. Arthur wrote in the piece that we co-authored for Contours, where he, again, you know, he enjoined us not to think about, you know, the African writer or Rushdie or Coetzee or Morrison as native informants and, you know, kind of these ethnic sociologists. And he used the word subliterary. They do not treat them, these works, as subliterary. And that's an extremely important distinction, that, you know, you read it with the kind of critical ballast you would bring to the so-called mainstream or the canon. And I had something to add to this. I had two very quick points. One is that don't just look at postcolonial literature or literatures in English in circulating as world literature, use them also as theory. So, you know, I mean, sometimes, you know, it's a very limited way where we are using kind of the toolkit of a certain kind of Latin Christian literatures to understand literatures coming from every other place on earth, you know. And I find Morrison, Fanon, Brathwaite, Walcott, Said extremely generative, you know. I mean, I want to sort of kind of look at their theory as literature as well, and I want to sort of not just read it as postcolonial theory, but theory. You know, I want to kind of remove that kind of qualifier that this only applies to sort of, in a way, the school of resentment, you know, that Harold Bloom called all these equity seeking groups. So that's one point, that, you know, don't read it as subliterary. Read not just the literature, but also read the theory, read the metacritics that these authors have generated, read the theory in the literature. I mean, Achebe is a fantastic example for Achebe's idea of tragedy that Otto has written on, for instance. The second thing I would say that our book is doing is it's not looking at one language world. It is about the English literary curriculum, but it is looking at what in the different places, the sort of many-tongued Englishes, you know. And as Otto says, that it's not just a question of, you know, India, where English is a vernacular. This idea of kind of the vernacular, something that is in currency in a way that doesn't necessarily serve the powers that be, you see this in different sort of Western and non-Western contexts. And I think one of our strengths is that, you know, our contributors are they inhabit different language worlds, though they are teaching English, that they are aware of other languages, they are aware of, you know, different kinds of intertextual, intratextual, intralingual, interlingual exchanges happening all the time. And this is what they're bringing to a certain kind of monolingualism that the traditional English literary curriculum espouses.
Thank you so much. This was amazing. It was a very enriching conversation. I'm in awe. Like, I was in awe reading this book and now having this conversation with you both. It's just been like so enriching. And I'm sure our listeners are going to learn a lot, as I did. I just want to take the time again to thank you both for finding time from your busy schedules. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anu.
Thank you very much. And always a pleasure to see Otto.
Thank you, of course, Anki.